This is Fuse Tea in 3D. Mouth-watering fruit, perfectly fused with botanicals and tea. Serve yourself a little me time with Fuse Tea. Listen to our ASMR Mind Tingles podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 442 podcast. I'm James Brown, editor-in-chief of the magazine. Today I'm joined by Tim Stillman, who is one of this month's contributors, and Arsenal fans will know him as one of the very popular columnists of Arseblog. And alongside him is one of our most prolific staff writers, Chris Flanagan. Morning, guys. Afternoon.
Morning.
Well, are you all right?
Good, thank
Excellent.
You.
Now, when we... I've got to just say, well, we'll talk about what we're going to talk about in a minute, but just to introduce you, when I said, look, we need to get a specialist Arsenal writer, I asked a few Arsenal fans that I know, and they all said you. We've had Boyd Hilton on, who's an old friend of mine. So are you? Where do you rank in popularity of Arsenal tweeters and bloggers and columnists? Are you above Le Grove?
Maybe on about that. I'd have to look at our respective social media followings, if that's like a decent gauge, but probably on about that level. But I think the site I write for, Arseblog, is probably at the top of that tree.
It's the big one, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Chris, are you Bolton's number one media player?
I don't know. It's not for me to say, I suppose.
But who else is in the field?
They have Lion of Vienna Suite is kind of the main podcast and things like that. So that's a very good one that I follow, yeah.
It is amazing now that we've got this whole era when really the fans have created better media than a lot of the mainstream media and have taken it off. We were talking about this when we're working on our preview issue at the moment for the next season. And I was saying, look, give the fans more space. You know, we normally have a little block with some quotes from fans. And one of the guys said, won't that make it less authoritative? And I said, what? One of our staff writers writing about it who never go to see Doncaster or Nottingham Forest or a fan. For me, I know this sounds ironic given that, or perhaps wrong, given that I work in professional football media, but I would much prefer a really great blog from somebody who goes in, week out, than somebody who's been paid to be there. Anyway, that's my resignation done. So look, we're gonna take a closer look at the in-depth piece on the big Arsenal feature we've got in the current issue of 442 in a moment. But let's start with the latest football stories, particularly the Women's World Cup. Have you been watching that, Tim?
Yeah, pretty much every single game. Yeah.
And has it got better for you as you've gone on, or what's the draw for you? Is it following England? I don't know if you've got a different team.
So part of it's work, to be honest. So I'm kind of covering it for a few different outlets. But I've always been into women's football. I've been going to see Arsenal ladies, now women, since about the mid-1990s.
Yep.
And I started off writing about them, and I just kind of got into it. And to be honest, it's a tournament like any other tournament. It's some games are good, some are rubbish, some are really, really good. And it's just football at the end of the day. So having watched women's football for such a long time, I don't really look at it.
I think the standard's got a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely.
The actual playing standard.
Yeah, and... Actually, I think one of the big themes of this tournament has been the quality of the goalkeeping, because this is the first tournament where most, like the first World Cup, where most teams have a dedicated goalkeeper coach. Even at the last World Cup, that wasn't the case. And I think you're seeing that coming out a bit.
And any standout players for you?
Not that many, actually. A lot of the more attacking players have been kind of in and out. It's becoming a bit more like men's football now in that the coaches tend to be better at club level than international level. But I think probably Rose Lavelle, who plays in midfield for the US, I think she'd probably be my player of the tournament at this stage.
Chris, does the fact that 11 million people watched that semi-final, the England match, mean that women's football can expect to see that sort of growth domestically now?
I think it can only help. I mean, we're seeing year on year now, it's just growing and growing and growing, and the finance and the backing of it is improving. And I think you're going to see that in all areas now. It's just as long as that interest is there, you'll get backing from sponsors and clubs, and I think it's all going in the great direction. And the fact that, you know, obviously two semi-finals now for England in the last two World Cups, it can only keep improving.
You see, I think it'll grow for the hardcore fans. So the fans that go and watch the women's teams, the facilities will get better, the playing performances will get better, the money will go into the game, but I don't know if it will grow as significantly as that audience figure suggests, because I think what we saw this week was England wins the Ashes, Henman wins Wimbledon, even though we only got to the semi-finals. And I think that actually, just for me personally, when you start having been told about football by somebody who's never watched a game before, which was happening on Wednesday, who couldn't tell you Phil Neville played for, or who Lucy Bronze plays for, or Jill Scott plays for, I actually think what we've done is I think the growth will be at the heart of football. So I think it'll get better for the existing women's football. So I don't think there'll be a massive intake. But for me, the exciting thing is, I think, just for the kids who want to play football. Because when I was at, I'm really old. When I was at school, girls weren't allowed to play football. They weren't allowed and I was watching some of the, they were showing crowd scenes, and just thinking that there'll be girls there thinking, I can be like this.
The challenge for it will be when the WSL starts again next season, alongside the Premier League, alongside the Champions League, and it's competing in that space. I think you're right, there's not going to be an explosion of ticket sales, but one of the important legacies of the tournament could be just what you said. First of all, not just young girls watching and thinking, oh, I can do this, but actually young boys watching as well, and not regarding it odd that women are playing football, and that it's, like I said at the top, just football. It's just like another football match.
Yeah.
But one of the kind of positive things for the WSL, they've got this Barclays sponsorship next year. You've got Tottenham and Manchester United are coming into it.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. It will grow from that respect, that you'll have slightly bigger fan bases. And look, if people are getting kind of disillusioned with the game at the top level now, I think the women's game is a really, really good alternative to that for fans.
So let's put one moment, the disallowed goal this week in that game. Do you think that the governing bodies of football will stay with the rules as they are? Because there was a time when, I don't know the exact rules, but they changed them all the time. But when you're getting ruled offside and the vast majority of your body is in line with the defender, it just seems to be, it's spoiling the game, you know?
I agree. I've always been a VAR skeptic for that exact reason. I don't think football has ever been the game that you boil down to quarters of inches. I just don't think that's the game it is. But that's the game it's going to become with VAR. I'm not sure if they'll change offside, for example, because there's the whole, well, if you're offside, you're offside, whether it's your toenail. I agree. I think that's against the spirit
of it. I think there should be clear space.
I
think there should be clear space between... You should be able to draw a line through the grass.
Yeah.
Because offside wasn't invented because somebody's knee half a foot was ahead of the defender. It was invented to stop people goal-hanging.
And the thing is now is that the way they're doing it, like you say, in tiny inches like that, the actual linesman cannot possibly give that decision because he can't... You know, there's no way a linesman can judge half an inch when everything's moving that quickly. So, like you say, you're changing the game in a way. I mean, obviously, the exact same thing happened with Jesse Lingard in the Nations League against Holland.
Yeah.
Another semi-final for England, and half an inch costs England. And obviously, it's easier for us to be upset about it because, you know, in both tournaments, we wanted England to do well. But I still think that it's... Yeah, I agree that it's madness
it's
over half
that
an inch...
It's not that VAR is the problem. The problem is the rules just need to be clearer, because what you're seeing there is at the moment, it's a great goal, really well taken, lovely flick on. It would have just electrified the game at that point. It's from the point of view of if you're supporting England or you're neutral, I think. But we watch football to see goals. You can say what you want. You can go back to the days when Arsenal were winning 1-0 and proud of it, but you really, really want to see your team score more goals than the other team.
Yeah. I think...
And it's stopping goals.
Well, the thing I don't like about it is now every time there's a goal, they're going to look through, you know, the entire 10, 15 seconds before that. So is there anything though we can find that someone's done wrong?
They should be looking for reasons to give goals, not take them away.
I think the thing is with VAR, I think you're right, the rules aren't written with VAR in mind, and we'll have to revisit some of them. One of the ones I think should be really, really reconsidered is the penalty. Because now you're getting far more penalties, and some of these offences, you're thinking, like, penalties are 80% of the time goals, and some of these offences, you're thinking, is that really worth virtually guaranteeing a goal for the opposition? Like, if someone's, you know, the ball hits someone's elbow, like, is that worth a goal?
Well, I think, but also, sorry, Chris, but also on that point, the ball hitting the arm, you know, whether it's women's players or men's players, footballers spend 40 hours a week booting a ball around. You tell them to hit a hand at 20 yards, they can do it. Yeah. You know, they're just in this point now where they're going to just be lifting the ball as the defender is in front of them onto the hand. Well, it's easy to do that.
That's why we're seeing more and more, and even in the last 5 years, the defenders, when they're defending a cross, will have their arms behind their back, which is crazy, really. But they're going to have to, after what we've seen with VAR, they're going to have to do that even more. But it's... Yeah, with that, it's partly VAR, but it's also that they're actually changing the handball rule to, and that's the two things are happening at once. And like you say, we're getting a lot of these ridiculous handball penalties.
Okay, speaking of ridiculous things, a man who spent a year managing a team to exactly the same place they had finished for the 3 years previous, Frank Lampard, very good footballer, very intelligent man, I've interviewed him, very nice guy, has now been put in charge of a Champions League Europa title holders team, Chelsea, because he was a very good player. Good? Mad? Promising?
I think it's a little bit mad, to be honest. I mean, ultimately, why have they given Frank Lampard the job? If Frank Lampard had spent his career playing for Crewe Alexandra or Leeds or Fulham, he wouldn't have got the job. So the biggest qualifier for him getting the job is being a Chelsea legend. And I don't know, I think this has become very fashionable since Guardiola, since Zidane, and now you've got Solskjaer, and it's always been there, that kind of let's bring back the club legend. But I don't know. Like, I just think, is that enough? Like, I think bringing Jody Morris with him, I think that makes some sense, given the work he's done with Chelsea's young players and the situation they're in. But as much as it gives everyone a nice glow to welcome Frank back, you know, 12 months down the line, they're going to have to look probably going to have to look at sacking him.
Well, I know that Paddy Power had a really funny tweet yesterday when they said, oh, that his first competitive game is against Solskjaer. And he said, in what they're calling the race to be the first sacking, so they can have a holiday in Barbados. But they're both those managers on Paddy Power, but they don't sponsor us, by the way, just following the tweet. It was funny. It's 6-1, you know, to lose their jobs. Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
It's definitely a risk and something that goes against what they normally do in terms of bringing in an experienced manager. I think this is the first permanent English manager they've had since Glenn Hoddle. So it's obviously a very different approach for them. I mean, I still think he did a good job at Derby, not an amazing job, but you say they finished in the same place. He did that with a much reduced budget than what they had the year before, and they also got to the playoff final rather than the playoff semi final. But I appreciate that he still wasn't. You couldn't say he was amazing at Derby. It's a risk. Well, there's no doubt about
I
that.
I think obviously, you know, I can't suspend my bitterness around them knocking Leeds out of the semis, but just trying to be objective, is that if you look at Norwich, Aston Villa and Leeds, they all improved significantly when those managers came in. You know, we'd finished 13th with virtually the same squad. We finished third. Aston Villa are in real trouble. Dean Smith has taken them up. And always, as all Brentford managers seem to do, you know, really do very, very well with very little in terms of name players at Brentford. And I just think we went down this at Leeds in the 70s after Revie and then Armfield and then Adamson. You know, we had Clark, we had Bremner, we had Eddie Gray. And there was mixed success with those legends. I don't think it's necessarily a good thing. When David O'Leary got the job at Leeds United, I was with the squad where we were playing away at Maritimo in the, which is a Portuguese island, you know, and it was a Madeira. It was on the island of Madeira. Mm. And the chairman then, Peter Ridsdale, came up to me. I was friends with a guy called Hayden Evans, who was one of the agents who looks after a lot of the players there, David Batty and Gary Speed and Simon Grayson and so on. And he said, where's Hayden? I said, I don't know why. He said, I need to talk to Gordon Strachan instantly. So, okay. So we went away, and Leeds at the time were trying to get Martin O'Neill. Martin O'Neill came very close to taking that job. When he didn't get it, they gave it to O'Leary because he'd done well in the meantime. But the managing director of the club at the time, Jeremy Fenn, in discussion said, look, would we be even considering Gordon if he hadn't had his playing career at Leeds? You know, let's just look at this coldly and look at his managerial performance. It was quite early on in his career. I think he might have just managed Coventry, and that was all at that point. Was he Coventry's manager?
Yeah. He was, yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it's that perspective. It's just, I mean, I don't know. I don't think we've been doing our predictions for next season. I think Chelsea will struggle because we hammered Derby three times. You know, they beat us in the most important game. They didn't look anywhere near as good as Norwich, certainly last year, you know, or Sheffield United or Wolves the year before. And you say he had a good season. I think he stood still. He had three good loans and he had a very, very senior team there. There were five or six Premier League players in that Derby team.
And as we saw with Solskjaer, even if it, you know, engenders a bit of a feel-good factor, that only lasts for so long. And, you know, that's not going to go on for, what's his contract, 2-3 years? Mm. It's not going to go on for that entire time. You know, they might have like a small uptick at the beginning where everyone's smiling and happy. But we also know that, you know, the Chelsea ownership and the Chelsea board, they're not going to be painting smiles on their face and saying, well, at least it's a club legend if the results aren't going.
It's like fantasy management.
Yeah.
And also, this is the most difficult time to take over Chelsea since Abramovich came in because of the embargo and Hazard going. So it's a tricky time. So
how long is Hudson-Odoi out?
I think he's back sometime, maybe 2 or 3 months into the season.
Okay, so he would be the player, if he wasn't injured, that they would be looking to light up the team with Hazard going.
Yeah, well, obviously they've got Pulisic, who hopefully will do some of that.
But he's new to the league.
Yes, oh yeah.
That's you the can't key expect, factor. Pulisic might take a season to go from 14 to 24 goals.
You can't expect anyone to be like Hazard straight away, for sure.
Okay, that's Chelsea. Let's move on from there. We're kind of, what do you think they're going to do okay, don't you?
Personally, I think they'll be
sixth. Sorry, because I had said we'll move on.
Personally, I think they'll finish sixth.
You think?
I think they'll finish sixth.
Sixth. What do you think?
I think maybe fifth.
I had seventh, I think. I think Leicester will finish above them.
Can't get enough eye-popping, jaw-dropping, heart-stopping reality TV.
It's the best.
Then head to Hey You, home of reality on demand. Stream and download the latest episodes from shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives, same day as the US.
What's more fun than that?
Or binge old faves like The Simple Life and The Hills.
That's hot.
Hey You, reality on demand. Start your 1 month free trial now.
Okay, let's talk about Arsenal. Let's move to your end of London. We've got this fantastic feature in the magazine this month, 23 reasons to still, it's still good to be a Gooner. And they've got the back cover. Can I just ask you, first of all, I live quite near Emirates. And as a non-Arsenal supporter, it's the Adidas campaign around the new shirt has been pretty amazing. The video that they did with the legends and the fans, the ads all over Highbury Station, all of the ad sites have got Arsenal on there. You got the mural. I mean, they've really gone to town with it. Is it possible that an advertising campaign can cover up some well-voiced disappointments over last season?
I think in a way it can, not in a properly tangible way. It's not going to make us a good team again, for example. But one of the things that I think Arsenal fans have been feeling, particularly since Arsene Wenger left, and we know that the end of Wenger's reign was quite divisive, but it was a very definite identity. Because whatever you thought of Arsene Wenger at the end, you knew what he stood for, what his style of football was and everything like that. And we've lost that really big reference point. And Unai Emery's come in, and Unai Emery is someone who doesn't really have like a particular style of football or anything that you can hang your hat on. And also Arsenal have turned over quite a lot of the squad recently. So there's a lot of new players there. So there's not many people or things we identify with at Arsenal at the moment. Not many figures that you can say, yeah, he's Arsenal. And actually what this video did really, really nicely was to recenter that sense of identity. I really liked the way they talked about, you know, Arsenal being a London thing, but London being very global and welcoming at the same time. So it really hit that kind of, Ian Wright's from Lewisham. He's one of our big legends. You know, here's a couple of shots in a greasy spoon. But actually, you know, the striker from Gabon. Yeah. And the midfielder from France can get in on this, and so can the fans in kind of far-flung corners of the world.
Because actually, that is what London's like.
Exactly.
If you walk down a street in London, you will walk past somebody from France, you will walk past somebody from Africa, you will walk past somebody from Turkey or Sweden or wherever you know. I think Arsenal reflect the community around them in many ways.
And they absolutely nailed that in a way that I don't think anyone inside the club has managed to do in the last couple of years, particularly under the ownership of Stan Kroenke, which is quite faceless, quite distant. And actually that video, really honestly, I know it's like a marketing video and that's kind of what it's meant to do. And it's a bit superficial, but really honestly, it really centered that identity again. And obviously, like, for fans of a certain age, maybe about my age and slightly older, you know, people that identify Arsenal and Adidas with Anfield 89 and winning the league in 91, and they really got that retro feel in, and the mention of David Rowcastle. So actually it did make people feel quite good, I think.
Yeah, I think they've done an amazing job. I mean, some people were sending me saying, look at this. Not Arsenal fans.
And I, you know, I was suckered in. I bought the warm-up jacket, and I don't usually buy merchandise anymore because, you know, Idris Elba was wearing it in the video. Unfortunately, I don't look like Idris Elba when I'm wearing it, and I haven't been able to get a refund on that
jacket. When would you wear that jacket to the match?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you wear Bolton merchandise?
No, not these days. I certainly used to do when I was young, but yeah, not so much now, yeah.
Okay. I'm not even going to go there. I'm quite superstitious around what I wear and how I go into the game.
So what do you wear then? Do I want to know the answer to this though?
I have all sorts of mad... There's a tree on the M1 that I look for on the drive up. And if I miss it, I think that's not good.
Right.
On the way to the... I know that's trees, not clothing. I won't wear red. I wore red to a game last year for the first time. I can't remember why I was doing it. Maybe I'd forgotten. I don't know what it is. And I think we won. But I was very conscious of the whole time that I don't, you know. I've got a beautiful... Remember, have you seen Savile Rogue?
Yeah.
So Savile Rogue, the guy who started that, is an Arsenal fan. I've got a beautiful Savile Rogue cashmere scarf. But I won't wear that. I won't wear that too much because in my head it looks too clean. But it's really nice. So I've still got my scarf from about 1975, which is just a rubbish scarf. Basically, it's just a badly knitted together old semi-nylon wool scarf, and it's filthy. Mm. So I've got that, which yellow and blue and white from when I was a kid. Yeah. But I don't. Yeah, it's kind of. I don't know. I mean, do you think like this level of stuff?
Well, I mean,
I think it's different from Arsenal because you've actually got real chance.
not really. I mean, personally, I'm very into like the retro kit thing, right?
Yeah.
So I've got like quite a good collection of retro shirts, and so that's a way I tend not to wear colours at all, just because it's easier to get served in pubs that way. but yeah, at home I'll usually chuck a retro shirt on or something like that.
I think myself, I used to be quite superstitious, but I think three relegations have knocked that out of me, unfortunately.
Okay, like, just let's come back to Arsenal for a little bit. I was chatting to a 442 reader whose daughter's at my son's primary school, and he was adamant he'd be happy for Emery to go now. And he was quite mild-mannered about it. He wasn't frothing at the mouth. I wasn't up to lock him down or anything like that. He was just, I said, are you sure you want a sort of a Moyes scenario? How long, first of all, would you, what do you think of that opinion? What are your feelings on it? And secondly, how long is enough time to give a manager?
So I'm actually in the same boat. I wouldn't have minded seeing him go this summer. Again, I'm not kind of absolutely adamant and it's not going to happen. And I understand all the reasons it's not going to happen. I don't think he's quite the right fit. I don't think he's a terrible coach. I don't hate him. You know, I don't want to chase him out of the club or anything like that. I've just never, I don't think the players we have and him as a coach, I just don't think it quite meshes. And I think actually the end of the season where we completely threw away top four and the Europa League final, I think at a lot of clubs, manager might lose his job for that. However, he'll get this season. His, I think his contract is 2 years with an option for a second. And basically, I think if he doesn't get in the Champions League this coming season, he'll go. And I think that's fair enough.
Do you think it would change if they shipped Ozil out and he had that, you know, I don't know what they'd get. Let's say, say his value came down. I don't know where he is when his contract. They said he got 50, 60 million for him. Would that sort of money to buy a new creative force? Because I think Arsenal fans were, I always felt, were too harsh on Ramsey. But as somebody who doesn't support Arsenal, looking in, he looked like a player who could change a game willfully.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Tony Adams has said that, was it Tony Adams or Henri? Sorry if it's not Tony Adams, but significant ex-players who've been coaches around the camp whilst, it was Henri. Henri, I think, said that he can't affect a game away from home. Is that just too much of a luxury? Clearly.
Yeah, I think it's gone on for so long now that it seems that he's hindering the team to a degree. Whether you'll get 60, 70 million for him now, I don't know. Who would pay that for him now? I don't know. A couple of years back, maybe, but I don't know. It would certainly help if they could get someone else in there to drive it, but I still think that wouldn't make them a title contender still. Unless it was someone seriously amazing, I still think they're quite a way short.
Who would you like him to? Well, do you want Ozil to become a home and away player?
I think it's in everyone's interest if Ozil goes, not least because his salary is about £350,000 a week, and it's stopping Arsenal from renewing.
Not dissimilar to Chris's.
And it's a bit like Sanchez at Manchester United, actually. It's stopping Arsenal from renewing. So, I mean, I think we're in a situation where not only would we not get a transfer fee to get rid of him, I think we'd be taking on some of his wages. So I think it'd be a free transfer and we'd still be paying him some money. I think that's how damaged goods he is at the moment. And
really, that bad?
Yeah. I think his career's just stalled, maybe a bit of the Germany thing in there. But for Arsenal, it's definitely the best thing.
That's interesting. Who would you like to see in? This week there's been a bid put in for Zaha.
See,
obviously a different type of player to Ozil, but an interesting approach. I would think he'd make a great improvement on the team.
Yeah, so I really like Zaha and I think he's exactly the type of player Arsenal need. A wide forward who scores goals and takes players on. I think that's exactly what Arsenal need. I'm sceptical about the kind of price it will cost and I think the reality of Arsenal's situation is they should probably look for slightly younger talent that's maybe a little bit cheaper with a bit of an upside.
If he came in, would he stifle Iwobi, who I thought looked one of the better players? I know he came on late into the game in the final in Baku.
So I don't think so. I think Iwobi would be slightly better like as a midfielder in a midfield three. I don't think he's quite got the end product to be a winger. But nevertheless, I mean, Zaha's just better than Iwobi, so it's almost not immaterial, but and also Mkhitaryan plays on the other wing and he's a bit up and down, so I think Iwobi would still get his chances.
Just whilst we're here, who is your all-time favourite player?
Anders Limpar is my favourite player.
Because, Anders Limpar?
Yeah, he was...
We had a sweepstake to see who you would say. I said Perez.
I think I said Ian Wright, yeah.
And he said Bergkamp.
I mean, they would all be probably in my top 10, but for me, it's Limpar because he was my favourite player when I was 10, well, 8 or 9.
Okay.
And I think your favourite player when you're 8 or 9 is your favourite player for life.
Yeah. I've got a funny story about Limpar.
I think lots of people have.
I don't know if I've told this before, but Tony Adams told me this. that the George just didn't get on Anders Lindpark. He thought he was, George Graham thought he was just a luxury, and he used to just tear a strip off him when he was really frustrated. It was always Anders Lindpark that would get it, and he'd always take him off everything. And he said that they came in at half time one day and they were getting absolute hammering, and then the players were sitting in a horseshoe, you know, round the left to right, George in the middle. So he started on the left and he's just chewing everyone out, you know, going through the midfield, going through the defence, absolutely bollocking him. They were furious. They were losing or something. And he turned to where Lindpark was, about to give him the mother load. And he was, you know, he said, "As for you, you can get your..." And he was stopped because Lindpark already got changed. he knew he was coming off.
But I think one of the reasons I liked Lindpark was because he was like the rock star footballer in a fairly functional, like George Graham team. We all knew he was a bit, you know, he was a bit of a lad, for want of a better word.
Okay. More than Merson? You preferred him on the... I used to like the way Merson flowed.
Merson's possibly my second favourite Arsenal player for many of the same reasons. And I kind of got to know him a little bit when after he left Arsenal. And yeah, I loved Merson as well. Still do.
Look, just before we leave Arsenal there, just you talk about Merson. I think if you want to... even Spurs fans could watch this. If you want to see a game where you see what Merson was about, watch the Do I Not Like That game, as it came to be known, when Holland stopped England from qualifying and basically ended Graham Taylor's career. Merson is just brilliant in that game. In fact, England are brilliant in that game. I watched that when Capello was manager, when we were playing very safe, tidy, square, you know, kind of almost like the old just sideway passes. And my memory of Graham Taylor's period of as England manager is mainly around that really disastrous European Championship in 92, when he took a lot of mediocre players. But England were brilliant that night, and it was totally unlike football. And you go, it's worth what you can watch it. I watch it on YouTube in like six, you know, whatever chunks. And Merce was brilliant in that, as was Chrissy Waddle, I think. Okay, that's it. I just wanted to mention that if anyone has never seen that game. Okay, listen, time now to find out what the most popular stories on the 442 website are this week. Here's Tanya Snuggs with a rundown of our top five.
Thanks, James. At five, a rundown of every incredible free transfer Juventus have landed in the last 10 years. At four, this is Anfield's Jack Lusby tells us what he wants from Liverpool this summer. We reveal every Premier League club's expected breakthrough star next season at three. Whilst at two, Andy Mitten examines the gap between rage and reality for Man United fans when it comes to the Glazers. And at number one, Connor Pope explains how new financial fair play rules could completely change the Premier League next season.
Okay, Chris Flanagan, you spend every day of your life watching and writing about football. I imagine a lot of people listening to it, and certainly a lot of people who read the magazine who are interested in how we do it, would love to have your job. How many people have you interviewed this month?
This month, Robbie Savage, James Forrest, Kevin Phillips, those would be the main three. There may well be others.
But also, just tell us who else you've done just this week.
Oh, this week. I've been in Luxembourg to cover Cardiff Metropolitan University, which are the first ever British university team to play in the Europa League. And then been down to Harry Redknapp's house on Monday to speak to him for our next issue as well.
And Ray Clemens?
Ray Clemens as well, yes, yeah, and Faye White as well. So
excellent. Yeah. He's just a machine. He's a football interviewing machine. So tell us a little bit about Robbie Savage. You interviewed Robbie Savage.
So I met him a little while back, and he came in like a rock star with the big sunglasses and everything. But he sat down. He was a really nice guy. It was the first time I'd met him in person. And yeah, we just basically talked about some anecdotes from his career, really, for a new players' lounge section. And he was telling me about some of the pranks he used to get up to, because I think he was known as a bit of a prankster during his career, and how at Leicester he'd always go into the club legend there was Alan Birchnell when he was at Leicester.
Yeah.
And he'd have an office where he'd get his food at lunchtime, put it in some sort of plate and leave it in his office until he went home for the rest of the day. And Robbie would always nick the key for his office, replace the food with the papier-mâché. And then it wasn't until Alan Birchnell would get home that he realised that his dinner wasn't there anymore. So apparently this went on a few times, and eventually Alan snapped and and got his own back when Robbie was having lunch one day when he was having, I think he said it was jacket potato and beans. And he just got Robbie's head, pushed his nose into this piping hot jacket potato and burnt his nose. So yeah, there's a few great stories like that from Robbie in this interview.
Did he talk about Leicester?
Yeah, so that was at Leicester.
How does he rate them? Because I think with Brendan Rodgers and certainly retaining Vardy as you know, the cutting edge, they've got a real chance again.
Yeah, I
think Daniel Storey is one of our regular contributors. Mm. I thought a really interesting tweet this week that, you know, he thinks they'll definitely make top six, possibly even hit the top four. He thinks they're going to do a lot better.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think the question obviously is still about Harry Maguire and what's going to happen with him. Because it sounds like obviously there's significant interest and he could be tempted there. And once you get to that stage, it sometimes becomes difficult to keep a player. They've got a lot of promising players there, and Brendan Rodgers, you know, pretty much every club he's been at has done a good job. So we'll be interested to see how much he can do with that team. But it's just whether that leap to the top six might be, you know, that gulf is just so huge.
You don't think they'll hit six?
I think that might be a big ask for them, but who knows? We'll see, I suppose.
I think Iosi Perez is a really, really good signing for them. When you look at the season they won the league and the job that Okazaki did, just playing off of Vardy, kind of being that extra kind of goal support and that kind of hard work as well. I think he's perfect to fill that kind of role. I think he'll really fit into this Leicester team.
And they really pushed most of the top four teams, didn't they, after he took over?
Mm. Yeah.
And they got, you know,
they thrashed us.
Yeah, you know, they were instrumental in helping various people not get into the Champions League. Okay, now Kevin Phillips as well. You asked the questions feature every month, which is when we asked on social media for the readers and those that follow us to give questions for key players. Now, Kevin Phillips, a man of many clubs and many goals.
Yes, many, many goals. I mean, obviously, he's hugely popular. Well, every club he's been at, really, because he's always been more or less top scorer in every single season that he's been involved. So, yeah, he lives in a lovely place in Staffordshire. It's very impressive. And a top guy. It's really nice to meet him.
Was his house nice?
Oh, he's fantastic, yeah.
Have you been to a lot of footballers' houses?
Not loads, but enough to think that was probably still, you know, to rate them, that was the best. So,
What did he offer you when you came in? Because, I mean, by the way, if you listen to, you can read the interview in the magazine.
Yes, yeah.
So let's get the stuff you didn't put in. Did he offer you a drink?
I think he did, yeah.
what did you have? Tea, orange juice, water?
Maybe a glass of water, I don't know.
Coffee?
I might not have had anything in there. I know, sometimes I'm fine. So, but he certainly offered me something.
Any food?
No, well, I'm sure I could have had something. I'm sure he would happily offer me something.
And what was the best at